Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Wilson against Career Education Corporation. Mr. Micco.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Doug Micco, and together with Marnie Williamson, I represent Riley Wilson in this appeal against his former employer, Career Education Corporation. The question in this case is simple. In an incentive pay plan where one party substantially performs all of their obligations, can the other party to that plan change the terms and actually not pay under its obligations? We know the answer to that is no. Where one party undertakes obligations and performs those obligations under a contract, the other party is required to follow suit and do the same.
But the problem, I think, with your case, at least the problem the district judge saw, is that the contract itself that Mr. Wilson had with Career Education Corporation reserved the right for Career Education Corporation to change these bonuses whenever it wanted to. And I would say a second aspect of this is the fact that you've assumed that the bonuses were earned as of the time the students enrolled, but there was probably a rather important function served by requiring completion of a year of coursework or the full program. As I will comment, this Court has seen cases where literally people were going out and finding homeless people on the street to sit in classrooms for a few days, and that's obviously not what these programs are for. So it seems that CEC may have had a very good reason for saying we're not really sure if the bonus is earned until that period of time is complete.
They may well have, Your Honor, and there are two points that I want to address. The first is with regard to the reservation of rights clause, the first thing that Your Honor mentioned. If the reservation of rights clause is read the way that CEC maintains it ought to be, and remember, under the contract, they have reserved the right to interpret it as they see fit, there's no contract at all.
Why do you say that, though? I mean, there's a salary, and the bonuses can be earned. It's just that it's, you know, anywhere from zero. I mean, law firms pay bonuses, and nobody is terribly sure what that amount's going to be, so I don't know.
Well, the fact that there was a salary here is really kind of a non sequitur. The salary wasn't set out in the admissions representative supplemental compensation plan. That only had to do with the supplemental compensation, the reason that we're here today. So the fact that there was a salary, while Magistrate Judge Brown found that to be impactful when it came to the unjust enrichment claim, it really doesn't have anything to do with the contract claim, in our opinion. The plan that we're talking about is set forth on page 29 of the appendix. I know the Court's aware of that. With regard to this notion that there might be very good reasons why you would extend performance or this notion that money's not earned until the students complete the educational milestones, that's correct. That doesn't change the fact that Mr. Wilson was vested in his right to supplemental compensation once he completed his performance, once he enrolled.
Why is that so? I mean, it seems to me you're assuming the answer to the question before us.
Well, it's so because it's consistent with the contract itself. If the Court looks at the supplemental compensation plan, right in the supplemental compensation plan, there's discussion of an evaluation period that starts 6 months after a student is enrolled and continues 15 months into the next calendar year. Now, if CEC's interpretation of the plan, that you never earn money under the admissions representative supplemental compensation plan, is given effect, no admissions representative would ever earn money under the plan. It's a one-year calendar plan.
Mr. Micco, let me ask you about that. With respect to the reservation of rights, how is this any different from a standard contract of employment at will, in which the employer is perfectly free to terminate the contract at any time, to change the terms of payment, but still has to pay for the work that's already been done?
Your Honor, there's no argument that on our side that CEC couldn't have terminated Mr. Wilson.
Exactly. But they would still, but just as, look, if I've had plenty of jobs, all of us have, where we served at will, and employers could end it at any time.
Yeah.
could change the salary, cut it, remove bonus incentive plans and so on, but they still owed money for work already done. Why is this any different? Is it any different?
It's different because that's not actually what happened here. Now, if CEC had had laid off their 2,100 admissions representatives, including Mr. Wilson, or had they gone out of business, we'd have no argument today that they were that Mr. Wilson was entitled to supplemental compensation, but that's not what happened. The trigger for the conditions precedent for Mr. Wilson continuing to receive supplemental compensation were that the student complete their educational milestones and that Mr. Wilson remain employed when that happened. And those things occurred.
But the thing is, the termination provisions of the contract I see as cutting against you, because when an employee is terminated, the person has earned a bonus only if the enrolled student has completed the entire course, right? Or the year.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now,
so why wouldn't that be the same if the plan is terminated?
The contract does not indicate that that is a forfeiture provision. The contract indicates that the two conditions that were required beyond Mr. Wilson's performance to receive supplemental compensation are that he remain there and that the student complete their educational milestones. There's the fact that he did remain there. So when the court asked, well, if they could fire him and get away with not paying the money, why aren't there other reasons?
Why doesn't that tell you something about the vesting provision, I guess, is one thing? Because in classic commission cases, if somebody's already earned their commission, even if they're fired, they have to be paid up to the date of the firing. But this tells us, doesn't it, something about vesting?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. With respect, our position has been, and I think it's one that's well supported, that the vesting provision can be, just like in any other commission case, the vesting provision can be forfeited. It can be forfeited by Mr. Wilson no longer working there. Now, CEC wanted to write in another term to their plan, allowing them to forfeit or to surrender, have Mr. Wilson surrender his vesting of a right to supplemental compensation. They certainly could have done so. That's what the court did in the Brozo case, where they specifically said the awards can be changed retroactively. Now, we don't have that in this case.
Well, how do you reconcile the reservation by CEC to interpret any provision of the plan with your interpretation of the vesting provision?
Your Honor, we reconcile it in two ways. First, as we set forth in our brief, and I'm happy to go into today, under typical notions of good faith and fair dealing, the only way to interpret that provision and allow this to be an enforceable contract is to interpret in a way that imposes that duty of good faith and fair dealing. In other words, CEC would not be permitted to simply use as a trump card its own interpretation if it's not a reasonable interpretation.
Otherwise, it's your position that provision, if interpreted inconsistently with the way that you want the court to, would render the contract as a whole illusory?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Is there any basis for the court to basically determine that provision, the provision being the right to interpret any provision in the contract, and ignore that, determine that it's illusory, ignore it, and then just look at the remainder of the contract as being a valid contract?
Your Honor, we had not argued for a severance of the interpretation provision. And with all candor, I haven't seen that applied in any cases that I have looked at. Now, I don't believe, having gone through the supplemental compensation plan, that there's a provision that would speak to if there are terms that are inoperable. However, the cases that I've seen where one party reserves to itself full discretion to decide the terms of the contract, which, without being glib, that's really what CEC is asking for here. It's front and center in their brief. Courts regularly hold that the contract itself then was simply an illusory promise.
Well, we also see that kind of language in ERISA plans, for example.
Right.
And there are still limits to the extent of discretion.
That's correct, and they're well established by the courts because ERISA...
And they don't nullify the plan.
They don't nullify the plan.
Could I ask you, Mr. Micco, to address the unjust enrichment alternative that you want to hold in reserve, at least? And could you address the district court's reasoning that the plaintiff was just doing his job.
Yes.
When he exceeded the so-called minimum performance goals.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because this, as we tried to set forth in our brief and as the court's question is geared toward here, really you can't have a contract that gives full discretion to one side to decide whether to perform and then not have a quasi-contractual remedy available. But that's what the district court held here, in part in reliance on the Hagel case, which said, you know, if you're just doing your job, then there's nothing unjust. Even if one party has conferred a benefit, the other party has retained that benefit, you lose because there's nothing unjust. This case is different than Hagel, and it's different for several reasons. Number one, by virtue of the facts that Your Honor just mentioned, CEC set out what just doing your job was here. It was reaching the minimum performance goals. Remember, the contract that we're relying on here, the supplemental compensation contract, it set a threshold of performance that was somebody's goal. Beyond that goal is when you receive supplemental compensation. So this isn't a case like the Hagel case where you have 100 executive employees who are just doing their job anyways, and during a tough time, management says, well, we'd like to do better, so we're going to think about giving you a bonus down the road. Here, we know precisely what Mr. Wilson's above and beyond incentive pay was related to. It was not for just doing his job.
And could you give us some idea of how about the relative proportion of supplemental compensation to base compensation for your client and for members of the class, as you understand it?
I will, Your Honor. And as I do
and,
so...
And, okay, I also have a follow-up question, which is how, after the 2010 plan was terminated, how was compensation changed?
Certainly, Your Honor. And as the court will recall, this matter was dismissed at the motion-to-dismiss stage. So I'm a little bit leery of speaking outside the pleadings, but here's what
I can tell you.
On an
appeal from a 12b-6 dismissal, we regularly allow the dismissed party to elaborate on their pleadings.
Excellent. Let me do so.
The fact that you didn't amend your complaint concerns me, but we'll talk about that.
Okay. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time already, but I certainly do want to address the court's questions. First of all, as we set out in our complaint, Mr. Wilson, an admissions representative, was divested of $9,200. Now, that's not for the year. That's related to the failure to pay for the incentive compensation related to quarter three and about three payments from quarter two. That's for half of the year, $9,200.
How does that compare to his base pay?
His supplemental compensation during the year would be about half of what his base pay was. Significant.
So it's
he made about $40,000.
It's a third of his total compensation,
yes.
Roughly. Okay. And how were things changed after the 2010 supplemental plan was terminated?
Well, as they set forth in their termination memorandum, CEC looked at ways how they might go forward and change the plan to increase base pay. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that some increase in base pay did take place. Mr. Wilson left because he couldn't afford to stay there anymore after the plan changed. I'm happy to address the court's questions about our failure to amend. However, I want to be respectful of the court's time as well.
No. Go ahead, please. Why didn't you amend?
In our position, Your Honor, is simply there was nothing more that we needed to say, specifically when it came to this unjust enrichment notion. There's nothing more that we would need to say to establish that this is either morally wrong or unjust for one party to provoke another into doing work above and beyond what their typical work is and then go back on the deal. Remember, CEC is the architect of the plan here. And with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Miko. Mr. Alamudin? I hope I came close to the pronunciation of your name. I'm not sure.
A lot better than some people have. Good morning. My name is Sari Almadine. I am counsel for Eppley's. With me, counsel table, is co-counsel Andy Scroggins and our client representative, Mr. Terry Gonzalez. I'd like to start by addressing the point that Ms. Smithko made about vesting, earning of the compensation. In our view, the plan language is clear and makes clear that compensation is not earned until several preconditions are satisfied, one of which is the plaintiff's performance, but not all of which is the plaintiff's performance. And the plan clearly provides that there are certain other prerequisites. One is that the representative must obviously exceed his or her threshold for recruiting students. The second is that the students must successfully complete their academic program or one academic year of their program in the applicable evaluation period. And then the third thing is that the representative must have been employed at the time that those benchmarks were reached. And that is a critical difference in our view, because under the express terms of the plan language, no compensation is earned until those benchmarks are achieved. And there's an example in the plan specifically that Your Honor pointed out relating to terminated employees that makes that point. The plan specifically provides an example of an employee who resigns or is terminated on November 2, 2010, and this is at page 30 of the appendix.
Example one you're looking at? Yeah.
That the threshold was 25 students, and as of November 2, 2010, the date of termination, 28 students had met the threshold. That employee would have received compensation for those three students above the threshold, regardless of the fact that he or she was no longer employed.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let me vary example one a little bit. Suppose on November 3rd, the employer decided to terminate the plan. Would the employer still be required to pay since those had already been earned at the time that employee left on November 2nd?
Two points to that, Your Honor. Our first point is that the reservations of rights is broad enough for CEC to have made a termination of the plan even after bonuses were earned.
You think so?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Why doesn't that render this whole thing illusory?
Well, that is one of the arguments we made below, Your Honor, is that the breach of contract claim fails in the first instance.
Okay, and in that instance, I know you all are arguing that Minnesota law applies here, and then that invites you into unjust enrichment. And I noticed that in your briefs, you seem to lose the phrase from the Minnesota courts, morally wrong. Why couldn't a court reasonably determine that it's morally wrong for the employer to make the promise, induce the reliance, keep the benefits, and refuse to pay?
There's several reasons for that, Your Honor. First of all, the only basis for the unjust enrichment claim is this plan, is the plan language. The plaintiff has pled that in his unjust enrichment complaint, that it's the terms of the plan.
That becomes a circular argument for you as well as for him. But the point is, if you go to the trouble of this elaborate plan with the examples, the definitions, clearly inducing reliance, you would agree that reliance is reasonable here?
I would agree that what we are encouraging is for the admissions reps to enroll students who are likely to achieve
yes.
academic threshold.
That's the whole idea, right?
Yes.
And so what's morally, I guess, unwrong about it allowing an employee then to say, wait a minute, you're telling me now this is illusory. I did all my part of this job. The students did their part, and I was still employed when they reached those milestones. You ought to pay me.
Because in our view, Your Honor, the enrichment must be unjust, and it's not just the fact that mere performance is not sufficient for a couple of reasons.
The performance is aimed at a performance above so-called minimum performance, correct?
Right.
We're not talking here about people who just do their jobs. We're talking about people who do what you really want them to do, which is go above and beyond.
Correct. But there's two things. One is that there's no dispute or argument that there was a legitimate reason for terminating the plan, which is that the Department of Education...
Retroactively?
Well, we don't believe it was a retroactive termination at all.
Well, you don't... Those regulations were only going to prohibit payments after July 1, right?
Correct.
They weren't going to prohibit what you're refusing to pay the plaintiff.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But we believe the term retroactive is wrong because retroactive would suggest that the employee had earned that compensation, and under the terms of the plan, they had not yet earned it. And that goes to the Chamber's decision, which says that if the Chamber's decision on the Eighth Circuit, where the employee sought severance payments or relocation of payments, the plan was subsequently terminated, he sought the payments for the relocation, and the Eighth Circuit case said there's no unjust enrichment, no unjust enrichment claim when there's no legal entitlement to the benefit.
So I want to approach the unjust enrichment issue from a somewhat different point of view, perhaps a somewhat more procedural point of view. It's very often the case in unjust enrichment situations that there's an asymmetry between what the employee lost, here are the bonuses, and what the employer gained. The employer gained more people in the classroom, and I'm not really sure how that translates into dollars. But my uncertainty goes to the question whether this was properly dismissed at the 12B6 stage, because they certainly did signal that they were raising an unjust enrichment claim. They signaled that work was done, and there's some amount of dollars by which CEC was made better off by the existence of more students sitting in the classroom, whether it was something in the amount of these bonuses or whether it was something different, it is a different issue as I see it. So why was this, if we assume for now that this was like all these employee manual cases where the employer has just said, you know, here's what I'm planning on doing, but it's not a contract, why isn't this something that requires further exploration?
Because, Your Honor, the standard is unjust enrichment, not simply enrichment. And again, under the law, whether it's Illinois or Minnesota, there has to be something morally wrong or bad faith element to it that makes the enrichment unjust.
It's unjust if the person has, I mean, you want to get into the whole law of quasi-contract. Somebody has been told in some non-contractual format, if you do this work, I'll pay you, you know, put a new roof on my house, and then you say, oh, we never had a contract. Well, you've got to pay for the value of the new roof. And in this instance, you wouldn't disagree that the representatives were encouraged to get these extra students.
No, Your Honor, I would not.
And that redounded somehow. Again, I have no idea what the dollar figure would be, but it surely redounded somehow to CEC's benefit.
Yes, Your Honor, but I guess the difference to the example there is all that needed to be done for the employee to gain the benefit of the working on the roof would be his or her work, and that was made clear to him or her at that time. In this case, there were some additional preconditions or prerequisites that had to apply before the employee could assume that they were going to get any additional bonuses. So it's not just their work in particular. And if you compare the facts of this case as compared to, for example, the timeshare case that a plaintiff cites in support of his unjust enrichment claim, there was evidence that the employee manipulated the commissions and terminated the employee specifically to avoid paying them.
So there are two models here. I mean, the one model which you're arguing for is to take this second paragraph of the general provisions and say that the commissions aren't even earned until the criteria of the later sentences are met, staying for the program or for 1 year. The other is that they're earned, but they're subject to divestment, you know, and that there are later events that could unearn them. And either one of those are models that find examples in the law.
Exactly, Your Honor. And we submit we win under either approach, which is why we argued both below.
I don't see how you win under the second approach for people who during this three-month period, you know, we all agree that as of July, when the regs come in, no more payments are going to happen. But these pipeline people for those last 3 months, if they indeed finished their classes, then there was never any divesting event, and it's done within a finite period of time. Why aren't commissions never unearned for those people?
Because the plan was terminated before those people who were in the pipeline actually were.
Well, I mean, that's the issue. I mean, even if the plan was terminated for the and we're not talking about new students, as I understand it, that Mr. Wilson recruited during those last 3 months.
Correct.
We're only talking about students who were already in the program somewhere in the middle of their course of study. So if they wound up finishing the appropriate length of time, why don't those people become, you know, bonuses are payable on those people?
Because the plan explicitly allowed the company to terminate the plan for any reason at any time and did so before those loans.
So you really have to get back to the plan and say anybody who believed that there was really was a right to a bonus was kind of a chump.
Well, it is no different, Your Honor, than incentive compensation plans that many employers have, or to the example of the law firm with associates. So the associates would have created, put in all the work. They might be an excellent associate. They might have billed 2,400 hours, tremendous quality, but for reasons outside of their control, the law firm decides not to pay bonuses or to reduce bonuses beyond what the expected bonuses were.
Everybody understands that, and you don't. Law firms, I've never seen a law firm that had a bonus plan as specific as this one in terms of timing, amounts, and so on. Everybody understands you can reserve discretion, but therefore the incentive is less compelling than it is when you offer very specific sales bonuses, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, counsel, I'm trying to think fairly broadly here, but what value, we're talking about the direction the law to take here as we predict what either Illinois or Minnesota or both states would do. What value would be served by adopting your position that would allow an employer to offer this bonus, induce reliance, receive benefits, and then renege on the promise?
See, Your
what
Honor,
value?
Well, I disagree respectfully with the hypothetical that suggests that we reneged on the promise because...
You say you never promised.
Correct.
And that they were chumps.
Well, what we said was we promised, but there were certain preconditions.
But he's talking about conditions that will be... He's not asking for pay for students who never finished that first year or first term, or for students who finished... after he left the company. He's talking about only cases that met your conditions.
But if that were the case, Judge, you might as well read the termination language out of the plan because you could never terminate.
No. That's not true at all. Take the example of just employment terminable at will. Okay?
Yes.
You terminate at will, but that doesn't mean you don't owe for work already done, right?
But in those instances, that work already done, the only prerequisite to it would have been, I'm assuming, I don't know the plan in effect. It would be only prerequisite would be you did the work. Therefore, for example, a classic commission case, you fulfill your quota, you get it.
Right, but you're taking the approach, remember, that if in your example one on November 3rd, you had decided to cancel the plan, you even after everything had been, quote, earned within the meaning of the plan, that broad language lets you retroactively renege on the promise. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the position you took. That's
yes.
The position you that did you take on this contract?
That is one of the positions, yes.
And if that's right, I have trouble understanding why that sort of approach should be honored. At least without a warning, we can change this retroactively. You'll be a total chump if you rely on this.
Well, two things. One is, well, I believe the reservation of rights language is broad enough to allow for that interpretation. It's not what happened here. This is not a situation where all of the prerequisites were satisfied and then we terminated the plan.
But everything that was within the plaintiff's control had been satisfied.
Correct, Your Honor. But if it were solely about everything within the plaintiff's control, we wouldn't need that other language. It would be superfluous. We could simply say bonuses are earned upon enrollment, but that was not the fact. I don't know whether that means that my time is up entirely or not. But
you have 1 minute.
Okay. So to go back to the point, the main point, which is the plain language of the plan, in order to reconcile all of the terms, requires that bonuses not earned until all the preconditions of the plan are met. And because we view the unjust enrichment claim rises or falls with the contractual claim in one of two ways. Either there is a valid contract, in which case the law is clear that there is no unjust enrichment claim when the contract applies, or two, if the contract is invalid and there's no right to benefits under the contract, the plaintiff cannot backdoor the same rights under an unjust enrichment claim.
That seems like a complete attack on all of quasi-contractual remedies.
No, Your Honor, because if there could be quasi-contractual remedies that are separate and independent from the terms of the plan.
Yeah, the whole point of quasi-contractual remedies is if you don't have a binding contract claim, then courts in their equitable powers will step in and provide an appropriate remedy.
Yes, Your Honor. But if the court concludes that the language upon which the plaintiff bases his claim, there is no right to relief under that language.
You've told us it was reasonable to rely on that language, on the
What I admitted was that it was reasonable to conclude that this was an inducement.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Mitchell?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me start, Your Honor, by discussing whether or not my client and the rest of the class, if we were to go forward as a putative class action, were really chumps in this matter. Take a look at the language of the termination clause in the plan.
That is what concerns me. You know, looking at the language of this clause, it's pretty broad. You know, if I were reading this, CEC reserves the right to terminate or amend the terms of this plan at any time for any reason that CEC determines in its sole discretion. And then they, on top of that, reserve right to interpret. What does that mean to you?
And, Your Honor, there are specific points of the termination clause that Your Honor has omitted. Those are these. If CEC reserves the right to terminate or amend the terms of this plan at any time or any reason for regulatory compliance purposes.
Or for any other reason that CEC determines. No, I was looking at the whole thing.
And in the sentence right above that, it's all that sentence is concerned with is regulatory compliance. Now,
you're reading into that or for any other reason a lot.
Your Honor, maybe I'm sending the court in the wrong direction here. I'm looking at the sentence that says that if CEC determines the plan should be modified.
Right. I see that is the beginning of the paragraph, but then they threw in a pretty broad right.
They did throw in a broad right, but it's modified by the entire paragraph. And my point is simply, this isn't a case like Brozo or one of these other cases where front and center in the plan, the employer says, this is discretionary, like the Cromines case. You're not going to get this money because it's our decision whether or not you get it. There's a very good chance you're not going to get this money. And it isn't just the plan that we're relying on here. The course of dealing between the parties, which is absolutely relevant when you start talking about unjust enrichment, Mr. Wilson always was paid this money under the plan, and he expected to be paid this money under the plan up until the time that the regulations changed.
And prior modifications have been applied only prospectively. Correct.
Only prospectively, as late as fall of 2010, the very changes just before CEC decided to divest the admissions representative of this compensation.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.